Welcome to Awake, the Sleep Health Podcast. In a world that often underestimates the importance of sleep, we are here to shed light on the vital role it plays in your well-being. Join us on a journey to explore what is sleep health and the science of sleep. Together, we will better understand what happens when we sleep. We will tackle sleep apnea and other sleep disorders. We will address the significant sleep disparities and what to do to minimize them. With you, we will discover cutting-edge sleep technologies and unlock the secrets to achieving better sleep. Get ready to not only be awake, but also to experience the transformative power of quality sleep and good sleep health. Hello, my name is Jill Friedman, and it's my privilege to have today Dr. Sai Parthasarathy, professor of medicine at the University of Arizona and one of the great experts in sleep medicine. Sai, even though we both know each other, our listeners don't know you, or most of them won't know you. Can you describe how you got involved in sleep medicine?
I'm a pulmonary critical care physician by background, Jill. And again, thanks for having me on your podcast. And I got an exposure to sleep medicine during my training, my last year of training. And ever since, it enthralled me and caught my fascination. Even though I'm a lung specialist and an ICU specialist to begin with, the brain is a fascinating organ, and how the brain goes into sleep and remains active during sleep was immediately caught my attention, because in the intensive care unit, we deal with sedation of patients on life support machines. And their brain at that time is a black box. And when they are in drug-induced sleep, or drug-induced sedation, as we like to call it, what's happening in the brain and how does that affect their cognition, how does it affect their delirium, became an area of interest for me. How well are they sleeping? And how does that affect their outcomes, long-term outcomes, as well as... So my introduction to sleep came from the ICU, of all places, as to how people sleep in the intensive care unit and in the hospital. And then I opened my mind's eye to the gamut of sleep problems that's happening out in populations in the community, not just in a clinic or in a hospital setting, but what's happening really out there. So it's a fascinating area, and ever since then, I've been doing more in sleep than I've been doing in pulmonary or critical care.
Yes. So if I'm not mistaken, you were recently, for at least the past 2 years, the president of the Sleep Research Society. So you're not just a pulmonologist involved, like interested in sleep medicine. You are a researcher in the field of sleep medicine, correct?
Yes, it was the Sleep Research Society Foundation, for which I was president, and I was on the board of directors for the Sleep Research Society. Yes, and I do conduct NIH and PCORI-funded research that is in the space of sleep and sleep disordered breathing, including sleep in people with long COVID.
Really interesting. So based on your long-term expertise, what are the three most important topics regarding sleep health and sleep disorders?
Yeah, I think one of the big issues is sleep health disparities. There's a saying that the three pillars of health are nutrition, exercise, and sleep. And the American Heart Association has now accepted sleep as an important component of cardiovascular health, for example. But then we find that people in lower socioeconomic stratum, people belonging to minority populations, are not sleeping as much. And there are various reasons, from social determinants of health to housing circumstances and other economical reasons, that are the underpinning reasons for why they sleep less or they sleep poorly. And if that is the case, if both of those are true, it is true that being disadvantaged is taking out one of the pillars of our health and setting those people up for health throughout their entire lifespan, starting from a childhood, a child that grows up in a neighborhood with multi-generational family units living together in housing with inadequate ventilation, which causes disturbed sleep, with grandpa waking up at 3 a.m. in the morning and a teenager being awake and playing video games maybe until 2 a.m. in the morning. It creates an environment in the household that may not be conducive from both disturbance standpoint as well as ventilation and safety standpoint. Just being in a neighborhood where they hear shots on the outside creates anxiety, disturbs sleep, and that poor sleep affects their ability to wake up the next morning, do their work, drive safely to work, and so on and so forth. So the ramifications are tremendous. And so to me, that is a big area in terms of sleep health disparities, and that we can go on for a long time about just that topic. The other topic is this connection between sleep and cardiovascular health. Heart disease and stroke, if you say cardiovascular disease, are the biggest, are one of the biggest killers in the top five. And if poor sleep is associated with poor cardiovascular health, not only does it create an area of us being able to improve cardiovascular health by improving sleep health, but it also behooves us to say that this is something that should be done by cardiologists also, not just sleep specialists, so that we can increase the number of hands on deck that can manage this problem. And the third one that is more time sensitive and current and present is the millions of people who have been affected by long COVID. And there are as many as there are people with sleep apnea. The point Feldman's estimate is that it's about 7% of people in the United States have long COVID. And with the virus now again beginning to rise and causing some hospitalization despite vaccination and availability of Paxlovid and whatnot, it is going to increase the burden of long COVID with new cases of long COVID that are being generated as we speak. Not just 3 years ago, 2 years ago, or a year ago, but even as we speak, there are new cases of acute infection, and 10% of them are going to lead to long COVID. And long COVID can manifest as insomnia and excessive daytime sleepiness. A lot of people aren't connecting the dots. Patients aren't connecting the dots. Doctors are not connecting the dots. I'm at a training institution yesterday in Philly, a patient I was seeing, and my trainee who's got 6 years of training experience. He's done internal medicine training, done pulmonary critical care training, and is actually doing a sleep clinic. It was very good. Saw the patient, came out and said, "This guy's still sleepy, but I don't know why." And I said, "Is he sleeping enough?" "Yeah, he's sleeping enough. And he's using his CPAP for his sleep apnea, but he's still sleepy." I said, "Okay." But then there was a nap test done, and it showed that his sleepiness was normal and under control. When was the nap test done? Oh, it was done in 2018. That's before the pandemic. "Did you ask the patient whether he has had acute COVID?" "Yeah, I did about 2 years ago, but not recently." When I go in and I ask the patient, and the patient says, "Yeah, 2 years ago I had COVID. I wasn't vaccinated at the time. I was deathly ill. But ever since then, I have sleepiness. I'm not as sure. I work in the insurance industry and I'm not as sure. I get sleepy when I drive 1,000 miles a week, but I could do that before the COVID, but I can't do that now because I'm sleepy and I'm worried that I'm a danger behind the wheel. And I'm also having severe fatigue. I don't have the stamina that I used to have before to be able to do work and come home and do work, home-related work." Well, what the mind doesn't know, the eyes don't see. And unfortunately, doctors are not connecting the dots. And this pandemic of long COVID is happening underneath us and is going undetected.
Yes. So I'm going to ask you a follow-up on what you just said with one question. You said that the American Heart Association has now included sleep as one of the 8 pillars of cardiovascular health. But when you look into what they've published, they focus exclusively on length of sleep. And what you just said reminded me of something. Good sleep is not just the length of sleep, but the quality of sleep, right? Those COVID patients may sleep long hours, but the quality of their sleep may be bad, and then they'll feel really tired. Can you expand a little on this?
Yeah, that's spot on. I think sleep has multiple facets. It's like a little jewel or gem or a cut diamond. It's got multiple facets. And one of them is sleep duration. But interestingly, the longer people sleep, if they don't sleep in the Goldilocks zone, if they sleep too little or if they sleep too much, they'd increase risk for death, cardiovascular related death. So we know more is not better. Optimal sleep is what is good. The question is, what makes some people sleep optimally and how can we strive to achieve that? But you're right. The other facets are timing, whether they're irregularly sleeping, you know, sleeping, going to sleep at 8 p.m. today and 11 p.m. tomorrow and 1 a.m. the day after and 7 p.m. the day after. That amount of sleep irregularity alone, even when sleep duration is normal, that sleep irregularity leads to increases for cardiovascular events. And the third thing is, like you said, is the quality of sleep. It's not the duration of sleep. Sleep is like food. It's just not the quantity of food that's important. The quality of the food that we eat is very important to us. And so similarly, sleep quality becomes very important. And how they do during the day becomes important.
So I suppose that among our listeners, more than one, quite a few do have cardiovascular issues. And I suppose that most of them, even when they go to their GP or even to the cardiologist, are not asked a single question about their sleep. I think that one of the goals of this podcast is to make sure that people become aware that they really have to ask doctors to start to ask questions about sleep so that they can be properly diagnosed. I know, for example, that most of the people that are diagnosed with atrial fibrillation have concomitant sleep apnea, but the majority of their doctors won't ever ask them a single question about sleep. What can the people that are listening to us and have any cardiovascular issue do to change that situation when they go to see their doctors?
Yeah, great question. And I think it comes down to knowledge is power. If people want to improve their health, they need to seek out trustworthy, reliable, scientific information. And your channel is one of those that's that conduit. And they need to advocate for themselves. They need to be health literate. It's not being literate. It's about being literate about all the health aspects. It may just not be just sleep. It's about cholesterol. It's about medications and side effects. And so people need to have reliable sources of information, patient advocacy groups, professional societies that they can reach out to and look through their pages rather than anything on the internet, which we know is rampant with some misinformation and disinformation campaigns. Sure. What you're doing is very important in empowering patients to take this knowledge in their hands and through that advocate for themselves. That's how healthcare is unfortunately needing to be done right now in the absence of all of those consistency and implementation of processes that are missing in a consistent manner.
Yeah. You know that we changed our name, at least the name of our website from sleepapnea.org to sleephealth.org. And we did this for a clear purpose. You mentioned the three pillars of health and you still mention sleep as the third pillar of health in the way you described it. I want to make sure that it becomes the first pillar of health because you can stay alive for a few days without getting food. You can stay alive for quite a while without doing exercise, but you cannot stay alive and functional if you don't sleep for a few days. After the first night, if you don't sleep at all, the second night, you are completely non-functional. So sleep really is the essential pillar of health, even though we don't experience it. We are not conscious of what's happening.
Absolutely. You're right. I stand corrected.
Before we stop this wonderful conversation, I hope that the people who are listening are enjoying it. Do you have an exceptional story that made you particularly happy to be able to improve lives of patients as it relates to sleep?
Yeah, and I mentioned the story to you before, but we embarked on the study for our peer buddies where patients are educating patients and mentoring them, and we're partnering with the American Sleep Apnea Association to make it a reality, especially in the middle of the COVID pandemic. That idea originated from a patient of mine, who also at that time happened to be a veteran, and who sat in my clinic, and I vividly remember him telling me, if anyone is having difficulty being adherent to treatment for their obstructive sleep apnea, namely the CPAP device, he said, put them in front of me. I will educate them. I'll talk them into being more adherent. And that sparked an idea for me to do a pilot study, the VA, and a PCORI-funded study later, followed by an implementation study later with the American Sleep Apnea Association. And I'm hoping that as we continue to spread that message, we can touch more lives so that we can not only do a better job diagnosing, but once we diagnose them, be able to get effective treatment or get the treatment to be more effective for patients. Because if they get the CPAP and they don't use it, it's going to help improve their health and their lives and their sleep. I think to me, that has been a very transformative experience, and that actually originated from a patient of mine.
So you raised a really fundamental issue, and I think that most people are not aware of it. From all the statistics that we know, all the studies that have been done, no more than 20% of people who suffer from sleep apnea have been diagnosed. 80% don't even know they have it. But among the 20% that have been diagnosed, most of them get prescribed a CPAP machine or a PAP machine of some kind. And then there is almost no support after that from the medical system for the next few months. And starting to sleep with a PAP machine is a real transformation into the experience you have falling asleep. And it's unthinkable today that if you have diabetes, you're going to be prescribed one of those devices and without any form of support. Everyone will get support to make sure that they are consistent in the use of those devices. No sleep apnea patients diagnosed and prescribed the machine will receive real support, or if not, the vast majority won't get any kind of support, which is why you came up with this wonderful program that you have been running and with which we have been associated. So it's really important for the people that listen to our conversation to know that even though some of them don't have sleep apnea, but some of them will get sleep apnea in the future, they have to know that once they get diagnosed and prescribed the machine, they should be looking for some form of support. And our association is working really hard to make sure that anybody who needs this kind of support will get it.
Absolutely. And people can go to sleephealth.org and they can enroll into the Peer Buddy program to receive such support. And thanks for doing that for the community of sleep patients, Jill.
Sai, I forgot to ask you a question, which is really important so that people understand what is your interest in COVID and your focus on COVID. During the entire COVID 2 years, you had a special role into the medical system in which you are a professor of medicine, right? Can you tell us what you did?
Yeah, I was in the as well, because I have an administrative role as being the chief for pulmonary critical care and sleep medicine at our institution. And as part of that, there are two hospitals and about 150 ICU beds. And there was a time where there were 110 ventilators that were in play, 110 patients who were on ventilators, and we had to manage them. So we had about 13 teams, so I had to be in a team of my own. And it was very sobering to see people just come and die alone, because at that time, people were not allowed to come in to visit because of fear spreading the COVID viruses. And people saw their family member through an iPad video, FaceTime video, to say their last goodbyes. And I could walk into a room armed with goggles and visors and covers, protective gear. And there's an iPad propped up in front of a patient on a ventilator, and I can see the family on the other side praying. And the patient is on a life support machine, literally in drug-induced coma. So those are experiences and things that I saw. And one of the things that really spurred me to address health disparities in the COVID space was just looking at my patient list and seeing that 90% of these patients, at least in our hospital, were people from minority communities that were in a disadvantaged situation. They are a bus driver, or they were working on another essential services, and they could not stay at home and stay safe and work through Zoom because they had to physically be at the plant, physically be at the location where they were working, be it as a policeman or a firefighter or as an essential worker in some other line of work. And had to contract the virus as they get exposed as a bus driver, for example, to everybody that walks in and walks out of the bus. And so to me, that spurred me to action, not only for promoting vaccination for everybody, regardless of their skin color, but also especially to address certain socioeconomic reasons related. And that could be non-Hispanic whites that are living in rural Arizona. And so we began to address vaccination in rural residents, to address the rural-urban health disparities, as well as the health disparities in cities amongst the lower socioeconomic stratum and the people who had better means in life. and so on and so forth. So it's opened my mind's eye when I saw people literally dying because of where they were born and circumstances into which they were born, and it should not be that way. And so that has really spurred me into action when I saw it's just not about being able to drive a new car as opposed to having to take the bus. This is about life and death was being determined by their financial situation or upbringing. And so that should not be that way. And so that has actually was very informative for me at a later stage in life to become more tuned to the importance of what we do.
Yes, it's hard to imagine a more transformative experience than that one, I think. Thank you very much, Sai, for this short conversation. I hope that we're going to have many more focused conversation on sleep disparities with you and other people as part of a more cohesive conversation. It's a fundamental topic and we need to talk about it more regularly. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into Awake, a sleep health podcast. Your journey to better sleep starts here. For detailed show notes, resources mentioned in today's episode, and additional ways to enhance your sleep quality and sleep health, be sure to check out sleephealth.org. This podcast is presented by the American Sleep Apnea Association, a national nonprofit organization dedicated to raise public awareness of the fundamental importance of quality sleep and to improve the lives of sleep apnea patients through education, services, peer support, research, and advocacy. Until next time, sweet dreams and rest well.